us. And so we'll wrap up our discussion of baryogenesis. And we'll do that by providing some concrete models. So yesterday, we looked at the three Sakharov conditions for the standard model. So the first one was baryon number violation. And we showed that baryon number is violated in the standard model. So we have baryon number violation, lepton number violation, but B minus L is conserved. And so in the standard model, you could create basically equal numbers of baryons and leptons. And there is CP violation in the standard model from, say, the CKM phase predominantly. But this was too small to account for the visible baryon or the observed baryon asymmetry, so this didn't work. And then departure from equilibrium. So this happened at the electroweak phase transition when the universe moved from the symmetric phase into the broken phase. And this also didn't work. It did not provide a sufficiently strong departure from thermal equilibrium. Basically, the Sphaleron processes that violate baryon number turn off too slowly. And so the universe just sort of adiabatically evolves into the broken phase, and you don't end up with any baryon number. Okay, so were there any questions about what we talked about for the standard model yesterday? Okay, so if it doesn't work in the standard model, we can think, well, can we come up with the particle physics theory that does make it work? And this seems like a plausible thing to do because all of the ingredients are there. We see that theories of particle physics can predict a baryon asymmetry. It's just that we happen to live in a universe that the parameters don't work out for the minimal standard model. So we can think about extending the standard model. And so today, we're going to look at a simple, well-motivated extension, which is called leptogenesis. Okay. So the idea behind leptogenesis is that we know that Sphalerons of the SC2 gauge bosons violate B and L, but they conserve B minus L. So Sphalerons tend to make B and L comparable to one another. The total baryon number is usually comparable to the total lepton number. So if I create a lepton asymmetry at temperatures above the electroweak phase transition, then this L total gets transferred into a B total. Okay. So I can use the fact that Sphalerons are violating baryon number to ensure that even if I create a lepton number, so I'm not explicitly creating an asymmetry of B versus B bar. If I create an L versus L bar, then Sphalerons will sort of reprocess that into a baryon asymmetry. And the precise relationship, there's some order one factor that relates the baryon number and the lepton number. But the point is that if I can just create lepton number, I'm explicitly violating B minus L as well. And so that creates some non-zero asymmetry. OK, so this is what leptogenesis is. And why is it more interesting to think about leptogenesis? Well, so the reason is that we saw that we want to break a global symmetry. U1, basically we want to break U1 B minus L. But all standard model fields charged under baryon number are also charged under SU3. Okay. And this is kind of why baryon number is conserved in the standard model, that the baryon number charges happen to line up with the SU3 charges. And so because SU3 is conserved, you automatically also conserve baryon number. So if I want to explicitly break baryon number, then I need it seems problematic because you need to sort of break SU3 in some sense, except you can't break SU3 because it's a totally exact gauge symmetry. So there are various ways you can do this. So for instance, if SU3 is embedded in some grand unified theory, then you have things that that can change baryon number. But generally the models where you're explicitly breaking baryon number, you need to sort of couple something to the baryons that's a gauge singlet, and then you couple something else to it. You sort of end up with these horrible situations where you're trying to break all of your global symmetries while keeping SU3 intact. So it can happen, but it can be difficult. But the models are a little complicated. Okay, so for leptons, however, we have leptons that in the broken phase, at least, are completely neutral. These are the neutrinos. And it turns out that we can take things that are neutral particles and couple them to leptons. And so then it makes it much easier for me to break a global symmetry with something that's neutral because it's already not charged under anything. So this sort of provides a natural framework for breaking global symmetries without doing any harm to my standard model gauge symmetries. Okay. The other thing is that we already expect new gauge singlets in the lepton sector for reasons that I'll explain in a second. So what are we going to do? We'll start by talking a little bit about neutrino masses. Then we'll talk about the Sakharov conditions in leptogenesis. So basically what we'll do is we'll see that in order to explain neutrino masses, we have to add some new particles to the theory. Then once we add those new particles to the theory, we automatically satisfy the Sakharov conditions in a new way. And so this provides a new way of doing baryogenesis. And then what we actually have to do is figure out what the asymmetry is that you get from this, which we did in a very sketchy way for the standard model. And part of the reason why we didn't have to do it more carefully for the standard model is because we were so far off from getting the right answer that you don't really have to do a detailed calculation to know that it doesn't work. But for this, I'll show you how you can actually calculate how much asymmetry you get. And you'll see that just accounting for the observed neutrino masses, you automatically can get a baryon asymmetry out of this. OK. So let's start with neutrino masses. So just to ask, in the standard model course, did you ever talk about neutrino masses? Yeah? They did it? A little bit. OK. Okay, so in the standard model, the neutrinos that are part of the left-handed lepton doublet are massless. Okay. The only Yukawa coupling that we have is something that's like Yukawa coupling of lepton, L bar right, Higgs lepton left. So after electroweak symmetry breaking, the neutral component of the Higgs gets a VeV. Okay. And what you end up with is something that's like YL V over square root of 2 L right plus L left minus. Okay. So this is a mass for the electron, the muon, the tau. But you don't get a mass for the neutrino. Okay. So a prediction of the standard model is that neutrinos are completely massless. However, it turns out that neutrinos do have a mass. And a way that this was discovered is through a phenomenon called neutrino oscillations. Basically, the idea that if the neutrinos were exactly massless, then I only have one Yukawa coupling here. And so I can diagonalize this Yukawa coupling exactly. So do you remember in the last class we talked about how in the quark sector you have these two different Yukawa couplings, and when you try to diagonalize them at the same time, you end up with a CKM matrix. So for leptons, you don't end up with a CKM matrix because you only have one set of Yukawa couplings, you have two fields. And so I can do rotations on both of the fields and diagonalize my Yukawa coupling. So what a prediction of this is that I should not see any taus going to muons or electrons turning into muons. Like the different kinds of leptons don't change their flavor under the weak interactions. Right? Similarly, the different types of neutrinos should not change under any interactions. But it turns out that neutrinos actually do change their type. So if the sun produces some neutrinos, say, that are electron neutrinos, those neutrinos can actually turn into muon neutrinos. And then we see that because they scatter and they produce muons in our detector. And we say, okay, well, where did that come from? You know, we didn't expect there to be muon neutrinos because the sun is only producing electron neutrinos. So anyway, the point of this all is to say that the fact that you observe these kind of changes implies that there's a CKM-like thing going on in the neutrino sector, which means that there's a mass for the neutrinos. And the mass of the neutrinos is very small. The mass of the heaviest neutrino is about 0.05 eV. And by comparison, the next lightest particle that we know about, which is the electron, is about 500 keV. So they're very, very light. So the masses are almost zero, which is why for a long time the standard model, which predicts massless neutrinos, was fine. But now we understand the neutrino sector a little bit better, and from these oscillations, we're able to deduce something about the mass of the neutrinos. Okay. So fine. So what do we have to do to extend our theory to include neutrinos? Just like here, to give a mass to the charged leptons, we had to put in a right-handed lepton, okay? A right-handed electron, a right-handed muon. In order to give mass to the neutrinos, we have to put in a right-handed neutrino. So mass for neutrinos generally equals new right-handed neutrinos. And the standard model neutrinos are all left-handed, so this is some new particle that we have to add into our theory. And I can use gauge invariants to figure out what the charge of that thing has to be. So do I want to work it out? So I guess we can make an analogy with the sort of quark sector. So in the quark sector, we had something that was like Yukawa coupling up Q bar left, Higgs up right, plus Yukawa down, Q bar left, Higgs star down right. This is actually a Higgs star here. So what we see is that this sort of charge of the Higgs flips when we consider like sort of giving mass to one component of the doublet versus the other. And if we look at the components of hypercharge, okay, this has hypercharge 2/3. This has hypercharge minus 1/3. So the difference in the hypercharges is 1. So if we extend this to the lepton sector, so we say, okay, well, I have this YL, L bar left, Higgs star, L right, plus Yukawa coupling neutrino. So I'm going to put in some L bar left, H, new right. This particle has hypercharge minus 1, and so if I want my difference in hypercharge to be 1, this has hypercharge 0. Okay, just by gauge invariance. And you can see that, you know, this has hypercharge minus 1/2, this has hypercharge 1/2, etc. So the point is that this new right, it's a SU2 singlet, it's an SU3 singlet, and it has hypercharge 0. So basically, in order to give a mass to the standard model neutrinos, I have to add something that is totally uncharged under the standard model gauge interactions. Okay. So if it's not charged under the gauge interactions, then it's consistent to assume that this thing isn't charged under any symmetries at all. Okay. And this is how you can end up with explicit violation of your symmetries, just because you've added in this thing that doesn't, you know, unlike the quarks, which have to come with, you know, both the left-handed and right-handed parts that are charged under SU3, this naturally accommodates something that's totally uncharged. Okay. So if we write down all gauge invariant interactions, my Lagrangian looks something like this. So it's the same term from here. And then because this thing is a gauge singlet, I can also write down a mass just for it itself. Okay, so if I assume that this thing is its own antiparticle, then I can write down what's called a Majorana mass. And basically what this looks like is, if I do it in two component spin notation, the mass looks like a nu plus a nu dagger. Okay. So for the left hand, or like the charged leptons, this doesn't work because if I try to take something that's charged and square it, I end up with something else that's charged, and this explicitly breaks my symmetry. Okay. But for the right-handed neutrino, because it's not charged under any symmetry, there's nothing that prevents you from writing this term down. And so this action explicitly breaks lepton number. And the reason is that this field here is charged under lepton number, but this right-handed neutrino field isn't charged under anything. Okay. Yes, Kira.
So yesterday in the tutorial, we discovered that if you added an extra particle, it's V minus L from the gauge symmetry. Mm-hmm. And so how is it that we're breaking it?
Oh, so that it is consistent to make it a gauge symmetry, in which case then you can't write this term down. That's right. Right, so this is a different scenario from that. So that's basically showing that it's possible to gauge that symmetry. And some people do that, and then you can try and connect leptogenesis to the breaking of that, spontaneous breaking of that gauge symmetry. But here we're just explicitly breaking it. Okay, so lepton number is explicitly broken.
So
it's really this term that breaks it. Okay, so if I took the limit where this m goes to zero, then my symmetry is restored. Okay, so this is the key thing that we have. So in particular, what this tells me is that all of my processes that break lepton number are going to scale like this mass, because if I set the mass to zero, I don't end up with any breaking. Okay, so after electroweak symmetry breaking, this gives a mass to the standard model neutrino. So there is a tree level mass even before we break symmetry for this right-handed neutrino. I guess I'll put these here. So what do we end up with? We end up with something that looks like y nu v over square root of 2 nu bar left, nu right, plus this term. Okay, so then we have to diagonalize this because we have some a non-trivial mass matrix, and what you find are that the physical masses are some light particle which has a mass y squared v squared over 2 times this Majorana mass, and a heavy particle which has a mass of about this Majorana mass. Okay, so what we'll do is we'll identify this with our standard model neutrino and this with our new right-handed neutrino. And what's interesting is that M light goes sort of like the what we call the Dirac mass. This is the term that you actually get from the Yukawa coupling, times a V over MN suppression. So what this means is if I make this other neutrino very, very heavy, I end up with this M light is very tiny. Okay, so even if this, so like for instance, in the standard model, the masses just scale with the Yukawa coupling. So if the Yukawa coupling were 1, the mass would be the Higgs-Bev. If it were 0.1, it would be 10% of the Higgs-Bev. Here, it's that number times this ratio. And so if you want to explain, well, why is the heaviest neutrino so much lighter than everything else, this is a pretty good explanation maybe of why. Because the mass actually has this additional suppression in it relative to all of the standard model masses. And so with reasonably sized Yukawa couplings, I can actually get very tiny neutrino masses, provided that this is true. So basically, this is telling me that I'm adding in a right-handed neutrino, but it's very, very heavy compared to everything else. Okay. And this is called the seesaw mechanism. And the reason why it's called the seesaw mechanism is just that as I pull up the mass of this Mn, the mass of my other particle goes down. Okay. So they have this sort of opposite relationship. Okay, so we see that nu r can explain the observed neutrino masses, the nu left masses, and that it can even explain why they're so small. So now what we want to do is we can say, well, I've added in these new interactions. So now does my standard model plus the new interactions satisfy the Sakharov conditions in a new way? So first of all, are there any questions about the adding in a right-handed neutrino or any of the stuff we talked about? Yes, Ryan.
You said that by adding in a term, you explicitly break the lepton number symmetry. Didn't we say that the standard model already has lepton number symmetry?
That's right, but it's broken at the quantum level. So I guess, so when people say explicitly, they often mean, well, they can mean various things. But in this context, what I mean is at the classical level, I'm breaking lepton number symmetry. Okay. So my baryon and lepton number violation in the standard model is very much tied to what's going on with my gauge theory dynamics, how hopping between these different vacua. But here, I can just have like classical scattering processes that change my lepton number. Yes, that's right. You're breaking B minus L. Yeah. That's right. That's right. That's right. And indeed, so one of the interesting developments of this Sphaleron, once it was discovered these Sphalerons were there, it was realized that a lot of the first theories that people had written down, they preserved B minus L but broke. Yeah, they preserved B minus L but broke B and L. So even if you generate a symmetry at a high scale, the Sphaleron just completely destroy it by the time you get to low scales. Okay. So what about the Sakharov conditions? So the first one is baryon number violation. And this does happen, okay, because we have a combination of lepton number violation plus Sphaleron. So basically what Kieran said, this breaks B minus L, so this allows the accumulation of a B minus L asymmetry, and then the Sphalerons can convert that into just baryons. Okay. Provided that all of this stuff is happening above the weak scale, but we've already seen that the seesaw mechanism kind of pushes you towards very heavy states anyway. So unlike in the standard model, where we didn't have any new thresholds or anything interesting happening above the weak scale, we now have something interesting happening above the weak scale. Okay. And so the Sphalerons seem like a very good way of violating our symmetries. Okay, the second thing that we want to look for is CP violation. And this also we have some new source of. Okay. So we have a new Yukawa coupling. Which is this Y nu. And if I want to give masses to three neutrinos, I need to add in three new rights. So this is generally a 3x3 matrix. Okay, so just like in the CKM matrix, we have a phase, which is it's sometimes called the CKM phase or the Dirac phase, but it's this this one thing that we're not able to eliminate by rephasing our field. But it turns out there's actually more CP violation in this theory, and it comes from the fact that If I change nu r to, say, e to the I alpha nu r, okay, nu bar r conjugate also transforms the same way, right? Because I'm taking a bar and I'm taking a conjugate. So that turns it to minus alpha, and I'm back to plus alpha. So this term actually rotates to, under a phase rotation, goes to a half mn e to the 2i alpha nu bar r c nu r. So I see is that this action is not invariant if I change the phase of the right-handed neutrinos. So part of the way we eliminated, you know, we said, oh, there are these phases you can get rid of by basically changing the variables of integration for your path integral. That doesn't work for the right-handed neutrinos. Okay? So it turns out that instead of one phase, we actually get three new CP phases. Okay, and so you have much less suppression. So in the CKM matrix, you had to go through three generations, like all three standard model things, and that's why we had that Jarls-Cog invariant that went like mass to the 12th or something, and it was very, very small. Here we don't have that because we only because there are three new phases, we really only have to go through two different generations. Okay. So this is good. Another thing that I should point out is that neutrino experiments can tell us about one of these phases. And that's something that sort of the next generation of experiments should tell us about. But it can't tell us about the other two. So it's an interesting thing to look for CP violation in the neutrino sector because it might hint towards whether leptogenesis is happening. But there's a lot of press going on about how, you know, oh, looking for this phase is going to tell us about the matter-antimatter asymmetry. It's not quite true because there are these other phases that don't show up in experiments at low energies. So from the perspective of someone who believes in leptogenesis, it's a very good thing because there are plentiful sources of CP violation. If you actually want to check that leptogenesis is what, you know, gives you the lepton asymmetry, it makes it much harder. Okay, so this is the CP odd phase. So we also need a CP even phase. In your tutorial yesterday, you calculated how the phases of loop diagrams are related to physical processes through the optical theorem. Basically, if you do a self-energy loop, the imaginary part is the same as the width of that particle. So you get something similar going on here. So what we're going to look at is the interference between processes between, say, nu right. This is the left-handed lepton doublet. So I'm going to write things in terms of the lepton doublet because all of this is happening in the unbroken phase. Okay. So so you have this stands in for both, say, the electron and the electron neutrino. And then there are going to be various loop processes. So I'll have things that look like this. So this is nu right, lepton, 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 Higgs, Higgs. And I'll end up with things that look like this. Sorry. Right. Okay, so my total, you know, matrix element of some process is going to go like the sum of these different diagrams squared. And because the mass of this new right is bigger than V, it's also bigger than the mass of this lepton and the mass of the Higgs, which are actually essentially zero in the symmetric phase. Yes. Yeah, yeah. Can you see? Yeah. Okay, so because this thing is heavier than these other two, then these particles can go on shell in these loops. Okay. And you end up with just the exact same thing that you did in the tutorial yesterday, where you found, okay, if I have a loop and particles can go on shell in the loop, so on shell in loop equals an imaginary part of the loop. And that imaginary part is a CP even phase because it's just related to the energies involved. It's not related to like whether it's a particle or an antiparticle. And so you can just calculate these the same way. So this one is literally the same loop that you calculated. And so you should be very familiar with that one. And then this one is similar. So basically, The way we often draw the fact that things are going on shell is we sort of do this. So this, we call it a unitarity cut, but the idea is that you're actually producing these particles on shell and then the rest of the process continues. Okay. So as long as these things can go on shell, then these things will generate an imaginary part. And it turns out you can use the results that we derived yesterday to generalize it, so you don't actually have to calculate the loop. You can kind of say, okay, I know these things are going on shell, and so I'll plug in kind of IPy times a delta function to impose the on-shell condition. So it's actually not too difficult to evaluate these things. So I'll just write down what the answer is. So because of all of this, we basically get that new left to L Higgs, sorry, new right to L Higgs L bar star is not equal to zero. Now, because this thing is its own antiparticle, there's no difference between a new right and a new right bar, okay? Because it's a neutral particle, it has this Majorana mass. And the difference in these rates comes from the loop. So we define this quantity that's called epsilon, which is basically the difference between these rates divided by the sum of these rates. And so what this tells me is basically the number of excess L as opposed to L bar per new right decay. So each time this particle decays, the fact that I have CP violation means that it's going to prefer leptons versus empty leptons some small fraction of the time. Okay. Yes.
What's that symbol after the final H?
Oh, it's a star. It's the complex conjugate of the H. So because it's a scalar, you don't put a bar on it. So you can put a dagger if you want to. I don't know. There's a lot of different conventions. Okay, and then if I evaluate these loop diagrams, what I find is that I end up with something that looks like 1 over 8 pi, 1 over yy dagger for the 1-1 entry. So I'm going to assume that the lightest right-handed one is the most important. So basically, in general, you want to sum over the asymmetry you get from all of the different decays, but we can just do it for one of them, and then at most the answer will differ by a factor of 3. Okay, so I end up with 1 over yy dagger, sum over r equals 2, 3. And then there's some function which looks like mni squared over n1 squared. Yeah, so that's that Yukawa coupling up there. Yeah. Sorry, this is I. This is 1. This is 1. This is I. So the point is that you'll see that if I plug in 1, 1, then I'm just taking the absolute value squared of the same Yukawa coupling, and it doesn't give me an imaginary part. So I do need to have two generations, and it's related to the fact that you can do some field redefinitions to eliminate the phases. Okay, but with two or more generations, then you end up with some actual physical difference in these rates. So this is just something that I write down a theory, and then I plug it in here, and this automatically tells me how many extra leptons I get versus anti-leptons. And this function, I mean, the exact form is not terribly important, but it basically comes from doing those Feynman parameter integrals that you had to do. So it's some loop function, essentially. So the moral of the story is if I have a theory, then I can exactly predict you know, each time this neutrino decays, how many extra leptons I get versus antileptons. So this totally encodes the effects of CP violation. So generally, what people do when calculating the rates is they express everything in terms of this epsilon, because it saves you having to drag around, you know, this matrix element versus the matrix element of the conjugate process, and so on. Okay. So we see that the second Sakharov condition is satisfied in an actual difference of rates. Okay, so this is a combination of the CP even and the CP odd phase. Okay. Are there any questions about this? I don't expect you to understand the, you know, how I get this exact form of it, but the fact that this is goes like Yukawa coupling to the fourth over Yukawa coupling squared should be clear from the fact that it comes from an interference of the tree diagram and the loop diagram. The tree diagram is of order Yukawa coupling to the one. The loop diagram is order Yukawa coupling cubed. Okay.
Sorry, when you have the imaginary part of Yukawa coupling squared and then you have one I,
It is a matrix, right? So if I take YY dagger, that's a matrix in the, because remember Y is a 3x3 matrix. Y dagger is a 3x3 matrix. So YY dagger is also a 3x3 matrix. Okay. And then I square it, which is also a 3x3 matrix. So. Okay, so the last condition that we have is departure from equilibrium. And all I'll say about this for now is that we have some new couplings, which can be small, which could lead to some rate being smaller than Hubble. And we have some new mass thresholds. So we have some. So this can lead to, so for instance, some Boltzmann suppression at some point that's like e to the minus m over t, which can also lead to gamma over h is less than 1. So unlike the standard model where we basically only had order 1 couplings to everything, we didn't have any masses, so we didn't have any sort of places at which we can go out of equilibrium. Here we at least have some scales at which you can go out of equilibrium. And we've seen how these things can cause out of equilibrium conditions for, say, dark matter, where for dark matter, at the mass of the dark matter, a little bit below it, it goes out of equilibrium. So a similar kind of thing can happen. Okay. But the details we actually have to, you know, as in the case of dark matter, we have to compute the Boltzmann equation and solve. So what we want is we want an equation that tells us how the number of the left-handed lepton doublets versus the anti-lepton doublets is evolving, and then we can just take the difference, and that's going to tell us what the asymmetry is. Okay. So I'm not going to replicate the full derivation of the Boltzmann equation, but so most of it is going to be similar to dark matter. We have this NL dot plus 3HNL is equal to minus some collision term, which involves all of my different fields. Okay, but there are a few differences, which I'll just outline. And none of these are things that would affect, say, your ability to derive the Boltzmann equation if you wanted to. You just have to remember to include certain things that we neglected. So one thing is that we can't assume CP symmetry anymore. So remember in the Boltzmann equation, we had sort of a bunch of these d pi's, and then we had sort of m squared forward, f initial minus m squared backwards times the final state distribution. And we said, oh, well, CP violation comes in at higher order, so we'll just set them to be the same. And it's true. We say that CP violation comes in at higher order, but now we actually care about that higher order piece. So we cannot assume that these things are the same. So instead, what you'll do is you'll say something like, OK, the forward rate is equal to 1 plus epsilon over 2 of some rate. The backwards rate is 1 minus epsilon over 2 of some common rate. So I can still basically put it in the form, but I have to remember to keep track of these epsilons to account for the fact that there's actually some small difference between the forward rate and the backward rate. Okay. And generally what we'll do is we'll keep leading order in epsilon just for the validity of the perturbative expansion, right? Because we're only keeping terms up to u cobbler to the fourth here, and that corresponds to leading order in epsilon. Okay, so you're implicitly assuming this is a small effect, which it usually is. Okay, what else do we have to do? So we cannot assume that the chemical potential is zero. So in our F, which was basically e to the minus e plus mu over temperature, we usually said, OK, the chemical potential is proportional to NL minus NL bar. And this is small, so we'll neglect it. But once again, the thing that we actually want is the NL minus NL bar. So we have to explicitly keep this mu around. And we'll basically substitute mu in for NL minus NL bar, essentially. Basically, like this over T cubed is this over T. Okay, we can still, however, take mu Higgs equal mu nu right to be equal to zero. Okay. The reason is that at low energies, the Higgs asymmetry doesn't really play a role. And this is the thing that's decaying and creating asymmetry. This is, so, well, I should say, this is its own like antiparticle. So its chemical potential is just zero by definition. OK, so we can still set some of the chemical potential to zero, but we really actually care about the lepton chemical potential. Okay, now we also have multiple processes and fields. So before, all we cared about was dark matter. And so we had a Boltzmann equation, which essentially just involved dark matter. But now we actually care about how this new right evolves and how this L minus L bar evolves. So we're going to end up with two Boltzmann equations, one for each of them. And we also have to take into account the fact that there are multiple things that happen. So for instance, we can have L decay, sorry, new right decaying to L Higgs. We can have new right decaying to L bar Higgs star. Then we can also have scattering processes that are like L Higgs to L bar Higgs star, which are mediated by off-shell right-handed neutrinos. Okay. So whereas before we just assumed there was one interaction, we now have to keep track of two, essentially. And it turns out that there's, just to make life even more complicated, there's one subtlety, which is that if I look at 2-to-2 scattering, say through something that looks like this, there's some resonance when this is scattering on shell. And if this N is on shell, I can sort of, again, put one of these cuts in the diagram. And then this process looks exactly like this process. So if I naively include my full decay of the right-handed neutrino and the 2-to-2 scattering, I'm going to be counting twice the processes with the right-handed neutrinos. Yes.
How can this go on shell? Typically, the right-handed neutrino has far greater mass.
That's right. But we're at T comparable to nu right, say. Then I can go on shell. Okay. And it turns out that this is the threshold at which the equilibrium stuff happens, or the out-of-equilibrium stuff happens. So there's some subtraction process that you have to do. So basically, you have to take this propagator and break it into a delta function piece that's the on-shell piece and the non-delta function piece. And there's some expansion you can do of the propagator, which is reasonable. I mean, in principle, what you'd really want to do is just correctly compute the 2-to-2 process, and that will automatically give you the 1-to-2. But you need to do this with the full finite temperature quantum field theory, which is complicated. So usually, this is a reasonable approximation that in zero temperature QFT, I compute these rates, and then I just subtract the on-shell piece from this. Okay. Some things, however, stay the same. So we're going to assume kinetic equilibrium for everything, which is reasonable. And then we're going to assume that the standard model fields are in full thermal equilibrium. Okay, so they'll have a chemical potential, but apart from that, they are given by exactly this function. And when we do this, we can write down the Boltzmann equation. So what we end up with is an equation for the right-handed neutrino. So it's basically, it's the rate of change of its abundance is just the width times its number density. Okay, so this form of the Boltzmann equation looks a lot like the form of the Boltzmann equation we had for dark matter. There are two differences. One of them is that we now have this thermally averaged width. Okay, it's because we have a 1-2 process instead of a 2-2 process. But this is approximately equal to the zero temperature width for temperatures lower than nu, right? Okay. The thermal averaging just comes from the fact that if something is moving at like finite speed, it's boosted, and so its lifetime is longer, essentially. There's a Lorentz dilation of its lifetime. Okay. But otherwise, this looks exactly like what we've done before. And similarly, we've defined this variable x, which is m nu, right, over the temperature. And this, which is n nu, right, over s. And this looks like a very nice equation to solve, because this just has the form of dy dx is equal to something times y. So that's just an exponential solution. The equation for the lepton number is a little bit trickier. Okay, so it has basically two terms. There's one term which we'll call the asymmetry generation term. And what this is telling me is that each time the nu right decays, and its decay rate is given by this, I get some fraction epsilon of an extra L over L bar. Okay, so this is just a direct following from this. That if I take the difference between nu right versus nu right bar, I end up with some epsilon. So if epsilon is half, it means that half the time the right-handed neutrino decays, I end up with an excess of one lepton versus anti-lepton. Okay, and this comes from just computing these. And then if I compute this, I end up with a term that looks like this. So what this, once again, this looks a lot like what we had for dark matter, where our rate of change was proportional to a thermally averaged cross section, okay, times the square of the number density. But it also is proportional to this YL minus L bar. And this comes from the putting in the chemical potentials into our Boltzmann equation. Okay. So what this term is doing is it's creating an asymmetry in L versus L bar from nu right decays. And then this term is saying, well, if I have an excess of L versus L bar, then this process is going to convert L's into L bars and try to destroy that asymmetry. Okay. So this is what we call a washout. And it's basically destruction of the asymmetry. Yes.
Sorry, before, for the annihilation term, we had, or I guess it'd be scattering, but we had
y squared minus y equal to root squared. Mm-hmm. Why don't we have that?
So that's because we're assuming it's in fully thermal equilibrium. So yl is equal to y equilibrium.
So what this ends up being is it's a yl equilibrium e to the mu over t, and then the opposite is y equilibrium e to the minus mu over t. And when I take their difference, I end up with a difference between the number of leptons versus the number of anti-leptons. Okay, so the difference is still there. It's just the difference no longer comes from the fact that the number density is different. It comes from the fact that there's some asymmetry between the L and the L bar. Okay. But otherwise, you're right. I can kind of guess the form of this by taking the Boltzmann equation for dark matter and sort of putting in appropriate factors of the chemical potential. But if you just take this and plug it in and follow the exact same steps that you did on the problem set, for instance, the first one, you end up with this. Okay? There's no trickery or anything. It's a pretty straightforward calculation. Okay, so there are these two competing effects. And this is basically a manifestation of the out of equilibrium condition, where in equilibrium, all of the rates are very fast. And so even if I'm creating some asymmetry, it gets very quickly wiped out by this process here. Okay. So for out of equilibrium, what we want is to basically have the washout processes turn off, but the asymmetry generation stay on. And this is the trickiest part about leptogenesis, or really any form of baryogenesis, is that we always end up with a Boltzmann equation that looks like a term creating my asymmetry and a term destroying my asymmetry. And if I turn this off, I kind of turn that off as well. Okay. So what I want is some separation. But I see that even though the couplings are related, they're not completely identical. There's a difference between this LH to L bar H bar and this width, okay, times epsilon. And so this allows me to have some small difference between them. And so if I can kind of have things go out of equilibrium in the right order, then I can have this turn off and still create some asymmetry. So just like what we did for the Boltzmann equation for dark matter, the way that we can qualitatively understand the results is by taking two limits, one where the washout term is much, much bigger than the other term, and then the one where the generation term is much, much bigger than the washout term. And so this is taking into account the fact that there are different regimes where one is more important than the other. And then that allows us to kind of at least get a qualitative sense of what the solution is. And it turns out that the actual solution is just some order one factor that's different from that. Okay, so for the solution, I imagine that I have some x, which is m mu right over temperature, which is increasing. And so just like for dark matter freeze out, I can consider two regimes. One where the washout is fast. So this basically means that my NL sigma v is bigger than Hubble. And here, washout is slow. This is NL sigma v less than Hubble. And in my regime one, if I kind of unjustifiably neglect the first term, what I find is that this difference in the asymmetries is just x over h. S sigma v, yl x squared, yl minus l bar. So this is just some constant as a function of x times yl minus l bar. And we know that this has the form of an exponential. Okay. So this tells me that y minus l bar goes like yl minus y l bar naught e to the minus integral c of x. So there's one thing that's for certain, which is that the first term is not changing like an exponential. So what this tells me is that if I create an asymmetry, it gets damped away exponentially quickly. So effectively in this regime, this is about zero. Okay? I don't end up with any asymmetry, because even if I were to create some asymmetry, it would just very quickly get destroyed, okay? Exponentially fast. And if you look at the full solution, you see this same exponential damping. There's some other factors associated with the first term, but this is the dominant term. Okay. So now we'll say that our universe has cooled to the point where suddenly these washout processes switch off. So now this term is negligible, and it's the other term that matters. Okay. But this looks very familiar. Okay, so this equation is actually the same as this equation. So I can just substitute them in, and I get this as minus epsilon dy nu, right, dx. Okay. Now you have the very challenging task of integrating this equation, which, so let me call this x freeze out. This is just going to be epsilon y nu right x freeze out. And this is the central result of leptogenesis, which is that while washout processes are fast, I don't preserve any asymmetry. But as soon as they shut off, every decay of the right-handed neutrino is giving me an excess of leptons versus antileptons. And so my final excess is just the efficiency of generating the asymmetry times the number that I have left when these processes switch off. Yes? So I'm just subbing in this equation here. So you'll see that the right-hand side is exactly the same, except for the factor epsilon and a minus sign. Okay. So basically what this means is that all decays of nu right after freeze out generate an L minus L bar asymmetry. Freeze out of washout, I should say. So of the processes that destroy, you know, lepton number. Okay, so now I can play various games to estimate what the size of this thing is. So for instance, I can say, well, you know, when does this process freeze out? Okay. So I can estimate what the cross-section is, and it turns out that the cross-section has, you know, a form essentially from dimensional analysis. So, you know, there are powers of the coupling, and there are, you know, there's this 1 over 8 pi. We argued before that if that mn is 0, then I don't violate lepton number, so I need to have at least an mn somewhere. And then there's a factor of, say, mn to the fourth from the propagator. So I basically end up with this as y to the fourth over 8 pi 1 over mn squared. So I can, you know, use this to estimate what my freeze out time is, et cetera, et cetera. And so what we find is that the corresponding mass of n in order to have this process frozen out is like very high. We basically need to have mn up at the Planck scale in order for this to work. Okay, so that's not very nice. But it turns out that there's one further effect that we need to consider, which is that the characteristic, like, how do I put this? We need to say what this new right x freeze out is. So this is true if I assume that new right x freeze out is equal to new right equilibrium x freeze out. Then there's some exponential suppression. I calculate the x freeze out in the same way, and this directly tells me what my scale of the problem is. But it turns out that if gamma new right, the width is smaller than the Hubble scale, what this means is that the decay time of new right is larger than the time of the universe. And so this can actually cause y new right at x freeze out to be much, much bigger than y new right equilibrium at x freeze out. So if I require this condition and propagate it through, you end up with the prediction if I want yl minus yl bar to be about 10 to the minus 10, I instead find the much more moderate result that this has to be bigger than about 10 to the 9 GeV. Okay. Now, this is still a big number, but it's a reasonable number. Okay. So the whole story of leptogenesis is saying that for large masses in my right-handed neutrino, which are exactly what I predict from, say, the seesaw mechanism, if I calculate the asymmetry and require that it be about the same size as the observed baryon asymmetry, I get everything to work out as long as this neutrino is heavy enough. Okay. This ensures a strong enough departure from thermal equilibrium. I don't really have time to explicitly show this, but it basically follows from, you can estimate it based on these equations. So, okay, so that basically wraps up our discussion of leptogenesis and the whole course. So hopefully you've seen that particle physics can make some very interesting predictions about cosmology, that a lot of the outstanding puzzles can be related to things in particle physics and different experimental probes. We've seen neutrino masses, we've seen nuclear scattering, we've seen all kinds of different things. And so there's really a very rich body of research going on in these fields at the moment. So I'm happy to talk about any of this stuff more later. I mean, I'm around basically all the time. So thanks for coming and participating so much. I really appreciated it. So, are there any questions about this stuff before we wrap it up? I realize this end was a little bit swift, but yeah. Okay, well, thanks a lot. It's been fun.